everyone, and welcome to Sped Homeschool Conversations. Thank you for joining us again live tonight. We are in the month of March, and in March we're talking about teaching tips and hints. And so we've got a lot of different broadcasts this month that are focusing on that. And tonight we're talking about Beyond Testing, Alternative Assessment Methods with Tyler Hogan from Bright Ideas Press. Welcome, Tyler.
Thank you so much for having me on here. It's a pleasure to be back.
It is nice to have you back. We learned so much the last time you were here, and I'm excited about all the new content you brought. Tyler has a PowerPoint to share with you, and I'm going to post that link right now, actually, on the comments so that you can see that. And if you want to follow along with the PowerPoints, you can do that. So that is on all the different feeds. We're on YouTube, we're on Facebook, and we're on Periscope live right now. So you can click on those links and see the PowerPoint presentation as well, and go back, right? And you have a lot of things on there that people want to go back and look at again and again.
Yeah, and I put some extra bonus material and references at the end that we probably won't go through live, but they'll be there if you want them.
Right. Yeah. And I was just looking through Tyler's notes and I was like, this is a lot. And then he said, cut some. And so you'll have to wait for the book to get the rest of the information. So Tyler, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and about what you do with Bright Ideas Press and what Bright Ideas Press is all about.
Sure. I'm a homeschool graduate myself. My parents started homeschooling my brother and I in the early 90s. My older brother was one of those kids who was just too smart for the program at his local public school. He was in the gifted program, and it was just miserable for him. They just used him as a tutor for everyone else. So by the end of the year of his third grade year, he just hated learning.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It was, mom just couldn't stand to see him like that. So she brought him home just for a year, she said, to try and reignite that love of learning. And before she knew it, she had graduated both of us from homeschool. So my wife's a homeschool graduate as well, and we're homeschooling our five kiddos now. So it's a fun adventure being a second generation homeschooler. Yeah. I meet more and more second generation homeschoolers, and it's just so cool.
Finally getting to be that age.
Yeah.
What's going on? Yeah,
absolutely. And we're, every year we reassess to make sure that, every kid is getting the education method that's going to be right for them. And,
right.
We look at sending them to school sometimes and like, you know what, we would be just such terrible public school parents. Like we don't know the system. We don't know what we would do with that. They wouldn't know what to do with us.
Right. Yeah. No, we're just going on vacation now because we're used to that.
Exactly. Yeah. Homeschool is constant.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And so my parents started Bright Ideas Press when I was real little. It was a workshop handout that my mom was giving on how to teach geography to other local homeschool moms in a support group. And it was a handout that just kind of got out of hand. And before she knew it, she had a book. And now... Yeah. Now my brother and I are running the company, and we publish geography, history, science, literature, pretty much anything but math.
It just runs in the family.
Exactly. Math is not my mom's favorite topic either. So
that's okay. There's enough other people that do math.
Exactly. Why go where there's already such good stuff? But we try and make curriculum that is designed to be used by families who have lots of different learning styles, have more than one kid that they're trying to teach at the same time. So we try and keep things fun and engaging. And usually when it comes to things like hands-on projects and activities, we'll offer way more options than any one family should try and do.
Right.
Because we trust parents know their kids, and they'll be able to pick and choose the ones that'll be best for them.
Yeah, exactly. And it's nice for you parents to know that you don't have to do everything the curriculum tells you to do.
Heavens no.
I remember that was the first video I watched on homeschooling, and the lady that wrote the curriculum, we use Konos, and she said, please don't do it all. That's not why I wrote it this way. It was just to give you options. And that was so good because my kids would not sing a song. If we had started singing, they would be out of the room. But maybe somebody else's kids really like that. So there is the option for them. So, yeah. Well, that's awesome. So if you're watching us live, and I see there's quite a few of you joining us, we would love for you to be part of this conversation. So if there's points in our discussion of assessment alternatives that you want to make a comment or have a question, definitely throw it in the feed, and we will try to make that part of our conversation as we're going along. So, but should we get started with all the things that you have to share? Because
Yeah, lots. So we're talking about alternative assessment methods today. And the reason that we're talking about that is because some kids just don't test well, right?
Yes, exactly. And yes.
And it's no fault of the kids. Right. It's usually just, you know, whether there's a specific learning challenge, like one of my daughters is highly dyslexic and highly ADHD. So, you know, just giving her the paper test that comes in the back of the book, that's just not going to be an effective assessment of what she actually knows.
Right, exactly.
So if in a lot of ways, it's just not fair to her to use that. But then you also have the problem, not only do some kids not test well, but some tests don't kid well. Like there's a lot of assessments that are just not really
well
written.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So there's three different kinds of tests that we run into on a regular basis. The first is achievement tests, and these are useless when it comes to being a better teacher, or for the most part, they're useless for the student and the teacher. So they're really designed to help colleges and businesses rank you. And then you have assessment for learning, which doesn't get nearly as much conversation, but it's a method used to help students assess themselves or get feedback from the teacher so that they know what their own strengths are and what targets they need to set for their learning. And that's useful, but it's useful for the student, not so much for us as parents.
Yes.
So what I wanted to talk about tonight was assessment for teaching. So that what are some tools that we can use to really get a good handle on where are our kids? What do they know? What are they struggling with? To what degree have they mastered this material?
Yeah, and it seems we'll stick to more of the achievement tests and the assessment for learning just because those are maybe the easier tests to give.
Mm-hmm. And there's so much material on achievement tests, but they're, well, that's a whole nother topic. If you want to get me going on the SAT and ACT, we can do that another night. I have opinions.
I know. I had one mom contact me last week, and her state requires a testing every year. And she says, do I really have to do this? My child cries through it. And I said, you know, you can petition your district to not do this, but legally you're required. And there's just not any way around it unless they allow you to not. And
that's so frustrating.
It doesn't mean that you're going to get anything out of it and you just have to pay the money. And unfortunately your child's going to cry through it. It's unfortunate.
Well, and a lot of my friends are public school teachers and they talk about having to teach to the test.
Exactly.
And that's such a backwards way of learning.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So I'm excited we're going to be talking about some different things. But you wanted to start out with Bloom's taxonomy, is that right?
Yeah. So Bloom's taxonomy, I think, is pretty foundational for doing any kind of useful assessment. And so some of you might be familiar with Bloom's taxonomy already, in which case that's fantastic. But I'll go ahead and give a little bit of an overview.
It's always good to review.
Yeah. So Bloom's taxonomy, it was developed by an educator named Benjamin Bloom in the 1950s. And then in 2000, it got a major update and revision from a lot of Bloom's students and collaborators. And it kind of functions as a universal rubric that moves from the concrete to the abstract and helps you give some specific levels to mastery, and whether that's skill mastery or content knowledge mastery.
Right.
So I have it up here as a pyramid, and we'll start from the bottom and work our way to the top. So the lowest level of the taxonomy is remembering, and then you have understanding, applying, analyzing, evaluating, And then the very top level is creating. So when we talk about remembering, that's your very basic, I can spit back these facts, this data, I can tell you the definition of the word, that sort of thing.
Right.
And that's the basis for our knowledge and understanding of topics.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding is being able to use it in context, use it in a sentence, tell me what this means, give me some background information.
Mm-hmm.
And those two levels, remembering and understanding, are pretty closely tied together because they're very similar. It can be hard to distinguish between the two sometimes.
Right, but like for what we see with kids on the autism spectrum, the remembering part they can do very well, but when they have to move it from one concept to another, that's where the understanding comes in. It's a very difficult step for some of them to take.
Yeah. So if you had to, like say you were doing a unit on charts and graphs and understanding averages, so the remembering might be, all right, tell me the difference between mean, median, and mode. You know, those are three important terms for statistics.
Right.
But then understanding is, all right, on this chart, what are the mean, median, and mode values? Can you point them out to me?
Mm-hmm.
The third level after that is applying. So this is where you can start to answer questions and solve problems. So if you had like a stock price chart of taking a company's stock price over time, you might ask, what year had the biggest difference between their high and their low prices? So that's an analysis, or that's an application question where you have to be able to look at the material, plug some numbers in, and figure out how to spit out the right answer.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
The fourth level is analyzing. So this is where you're starting to really move from the concrete to the abstract. This is where you can start doing compare and contrast kinds of questions, where you're starting to ask your own research questions, where you can test a hypothesis, that sort of thing. So if you had that stock price chart and a company timeline, so now you have two different pieces of data, being able to say what year, or looking at the two events, you know, the stock prices and the timeline, which events on the timeline seem to have had the biggest positive impact on stock price. So you're having to make connections between two different pieces of information, and that's what analyzing is all about.
Right. Yeah, it's the taking the understanding and up to a whole nother level. Just kind of go beyond that applying.
Yep. And if you're a fan of classical education, you're probably seeing some connections to the grammar, logic, and rhetoric stages here. Mm-hmm. So remembering and understanding would be the grammar stage. Applying and analyzing is the logic stage. And then the last two, evaluating and creating, are the rhetoric stage. So in evaluating, you're being able to make arguments to justify and rank value or rank order. You're able to start asking questions about the questions. Like an evaluation kind of problem might be, let's say you wanted to create a visualization of lion populations in 20 different African countries. What would be the best way to visualize that data? Now that's a real tricky thing to do, because not only do you don't even have to solve the problem. Like, you're not actually asked to make the visualization, but you have to know enough about different kinds of maps and charts and graphs to figure out what's the right tool for the job. So if you say, all right, we're going to do a bar graph, well, that's a different evaluation than a heat map. And that's the evaluation level where you have to start really thinking about what's the best way to use this information.
Right. Yeah. You transfer that to people so they have an immediate understanding versus having to dig in and gather some information on their own.
And if you're doing, I mean, we've used mostly math examples here, but this is where you can start doing like literary analysis and explication. This is where you're starting to write the more in-depth book reports and give details about theme and, you know, what the authorial intent was and that sort of thing. That's the evaluation level as well. And then lastly, you have the creating level. This is where you're not just evaluating someone else's work, but you're putting together something new. Hmm. You're taking all that you've learned and being able to put together a new creation that somebody else could then take and evaluate.
Yeah.
So you can see these go from the very simple to the very complex, the easy to the difficult. And the hard part about assessing our kids is that if we have a paper test that comes in the back of the book, most of the time those stop at the application level.
Right.
Because a Scantron,
as far as I see, yes.
Yeah, your basic kinds of short answer, multiple choice, true, false, and matching questions, they're not going to be able to take you much farther than application. They might be able to do a little bit of analyzing, mm-hmm. and maybe, just maybe, they can get into evaluation. But that's a pretty rare thing to see. Most of the time, they're testing those three lower realms. Mm-hmm. And that's useful. But we also, if you're looking for mastery, we need to be able to test the higher realms as well.
Yes, exactly. And a lot of kids, if they're extremely creative, will jump to those very quickly. Yes. And so understanding trying to figure out what they really understand when they want to convey their knowledge in those more creative evaluating modes becomes difficult.
Yeah, I can think of a time my daughter was studying ancient Greece in history class, and my wife Helen was teaching about the life and death of Socrates. Mm. And you know, Socrates has this, you know, big dramatic trial, and he's sentenced to death by poison, and he has to drink the hemlock of his own volition, and it's all very dramatic. And my one daughter, who is extremely creative and theatrical and just loves to dramatize everything, mm-hmm. In a good way. She did exactly what you said. She jumped to the creating level. And mm-hmm. as my wife was asking her, hey, can you tell me anything about the lesson that we just talked about? She reenacted the entire thing.
Oh, wow.
Now, yeah. She could not tell you the name of the person, mm-hmm. the city that he lived in, or any of the dates, like all of that remembering level, facts, definitions, and data, that was mm-hmm. not there. But boy, she knew the story. She caught the emotion and the drama of it. And that was, you know, for us trying to evaluate her, that tells us, all right, she gets the idea, but she does not have some of these foundational elements down yet. Mm-hmm. And that's still a useful evaluation, even if it's not, if she's getting her Bloom's taxonomy upside down.
Well, and you know, to a certain point, for kids that can't remember well, or they don't have those data banks, you know, mm-hmm. for those facts and those types of things, what do we want more? We want more that they have an understanding and can interpolate it, and that those types of things, like your daughter did, are going to be things that they remember from a long time, if not the rest of their life. My kids remember their reenactments still.
Absolutely.
They're in their 20s. And I'm sure you probably had some of those same type of experiences in your home.
Oh, for sure.
That have stuck. The dates and names may have flitted away, but
Yeah, but the heart was there. And the most important thing we were able to assess was that she not only gets it, but she loves it.
Yeah.
And that's hugely important, because we want to develop not just mastery of content, but a love for learning. So
yes, exactly. So true. So you have some tools to share with us.
Yeah, and Bloom's taxonomy will be foundational for all three of these. But the first one mm-hmm. is questioning.
That's a very good one.
It is. And I think this is something that is kind of intuitive for a lot of people. They're good at just knowing the kinds of questions to ask and pacing them and drawing things out of people. But not all of us are good at that. Sometimes that needs to be.
We don't phrase our questions exactly the way we should to get the types of answers out of our children that they need to give us.
Yeah. So, but fortunately, it's a learnable skill. Like it's not something we can't get better at. So I want to go over just a few things to help us ask good questions and also to ask questions well. But just as a little bit of background, questioning used to be in the American educational system before standardized testing was a thing. This used to be how everybody was examined. You know, whether you were taking high school or collegiate exams, people would stand before a panel and be asked lots of questions at all of these different Bloom levels to see how well they had mastered the material. And there were reasons that kind of faded out of the system. Part of that was because there was bias that could influence people's results in a negative way or a positive way. And that's something that we have to be careful about as parents too. You know, we can be biased both for and against our children at certain topics. So we have to be careful to try and keep things as objective as possible.
Right. I find rubrics are as good for me as for my child when
absolutely.
I'm trying to evaluate things like that. And so I have a gauge as to what gets what amount of points. And
My wife and I used to teach a high school writing class, and we often let the students pick their own topics. And sometimes they would come back with topics that were really fascinating to us. And other times they would come back with, you know, something that was really fascinating to them, but, you know, we could barely care less about. So having that rubric was a protection to make sure that they got a fair grade, no matter whether that they were playing to our favorite topics.
Right.
So let's talk about asking good questions. There's three levels of questions, and these kind of correspond to two groups at a time on that Bloom taxonomy chart, or the grammar logic rhetoric model, if you like the classical model for that. But observation, interpretation, and evaluation are two or are three strong ways to break your questions into these categories. So your observation questions, these are going to be real simple. You know, it's the basic journalistic 5 W's and an H. Mm-hmm. You know, do they know these facts? Can they tell you what this is and how it works? Mm-hmm. The very basics. And usually you'll have a lot more observation questions than anything else, because there's oftentimes a lot of information and you need to see, did they comprehend all of it before you can move on to the next stage? And if they don't comprehend things, if their observation questions are showing that they really don't have a grasp of it at the foundational level, then don't move on. It's okay to just stop right there and say, okay, well, I now know exactly what I need to know in order to tailor our next study session. So if they're just absolutely having a hard time with this, don't keep asking harder questions. I mean, that seems kind of obvious, but it needs to be said, I think. The interpretation questions get a little bit more interesting. So these are the, you know, what does this mean? How is that significant? What's the point? You're doing the analysis, compare and contrast, looking for cause and effect. And this is also a good place to get them to talk about opinions and feelings. So this doesn't have to all be objective data, especially if you have a student where you're looking to try and, you know, help them build their empathy skills. You know, how do you think this character felt at this time? Or, you know, what do you think was going through this historical figure's mind at this period of history? What are the kinds of things that they were concerned about? You know, those can be good not just for assessing them, but also for helping them to think through some things that might not come naturally to them.
Right. Yeah. To bring those ideas into play as they're thinking through that, because it actually builds those bridges, those neural nets further into their brain to memorize when you start asking these types of questions.
Absolutely.
So they're learning, not just being assessed, which is the great thing about asking questions.
Yeah. And then lastly, the evaluation level questions. These are where you're getting into the evaluation and creation level. on Bloom's taxonomy. So tell me, you know, was this effective or not? How successful do you think the Marshall Plan was in revitalizing the economy in post-World War II Europe? Like, that's a deep question right there. And that,
right,
if you've been talking a lot about the Marshall Plan, they should be able to assess that. But that requires a lot of background knowledge. So
yes,
if they're able to go that deep, mm-hmm, you know, if they can argue for or against something and make cogent points, mm-hmm, then that really shows you, yeah, they've got this down pat. And you know, there's maturity. Like their cogent points may not have all of the different aspects that might need to be considered, but they've considered all the things that you've asked them to, and that's enough in terms of evaluation.
Definitely. We have a guest that said hi from Sisters, Oregon. Awesome. Thanks for joining us.
So we talked about asking good questions. Let's talk a little bit about asking questions well. So,
yes.
So these are three simple principles for being a good questioner. The first is pause. Because pausing gives our kids time to think.
Yeah, we don't want those answers to just be quick.
Right, especially at the higher levels where they need to be more deep and thoughtful. Mm-hmm. If you're asking questions and you're just trying to fill the space because awkward silences are hard on you.
Exactly. Start counting.
Yes. Yeah, please, because it's not a service to your kids. They need to know it's safe to just take a minute, think through what you know, and give a good answer. So allow pauses, give them time to think. And sometimes, you know, our natural inclination, if they seem to be struggling, is to give them a prompt. Mm. And I would say, if you want to prompt for the lower level kinds of questions, the observation questions, like, you know, it starts with an X or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's okay to do that if they're really not getting anywhere without any prompting, but make sure you've given them some time and realize that you've lowered the bar when you give them a prompt. So this tells you that it may be in there somewhere, but if they can only answer with a prompt, then they haven't really mastered it and they haven't really recognized it independently. So you'll need to go back and work on building some more, you know, mental hooks to attach to this piece of information so that they can recall it more easily. Mm-hmm. So it's okay to prompt, but don't be too quick to do it. What I think is more effective than prompting, especially in the interpretation level, mm-hmm, is rephrasing.
Yeah.
Prompting lowers the bar. Rephrasing does not, as long as you're not giving them the answer in the question. Mm-hmm. Clarifying the question and restating it is super helpful, because a lot of times the questions that are in our books or the questions that we come up with are very stilted. The language is just not what we're used to hearing, and it can throw kids off.
Can. I mean, it's nice for them to get questions from somebody that they're not used to talking to, because it is a different language and our kids will need to learn how to take tests. That's just a life skill. Mm-hmm. And so giving them those, but having that rephrasing and maybe into words that you more use in your household than what was used in the text.
Mm-hmm.
I know my son was thrown by one math book we used. It was Singapore math, and they talked about prawns all the time. And every time he heard that word, his brain went, shoo! It's like, what was that? And, I mean, you throw a superhero into the word problem, and all of a sudden he had it, you know, mastered in seconds. But when you start introducing these objects he knew nothing about.
Yeah, and it's totally fine to just replace the object if that's a weird terminology or something like that. That's really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last principle here is on prompting, and I don't mean prompting to give them answers, but prompting for more information. So obviously you want to avoid leading questions like, you know, well, don't you think that X, Y, and Z, because that's just saying, all right, so how loudly can you agree with my interpretation?
Right. And, give them that, exactly.
And similarly, you know, yes, no kinds of questions that are, you know, very closed. Sometimes that's okay for the observation level, but once you get past the bare necessities and you want them to give more than just a one word or a one phrase answer, sometimes they don't realize what you're looking for. Like if you're looking for a short essay and they're only giving you a short phrase, you need to prompt them and try and draw things out a little bit more. So, but doing that can be a little bit tricky. So you want to make sure that you're not putting them on the defensive. So like the go-to, well, why or why not? That oftentimes that comes across as, well, uh-oh, my answer is wrong. I need to I need to either pivot or switch gears, or maybe I need to just start all over from scratch. Mm-hmm. So if you couch that in a little bit more of a conversational phrase, like, well, that's interesting. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Or, oh, I like where you're going with that. You know, give them a little bit of encouragement to let them know that they're on the right track, but they need to give some more details and some more information.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And these kinds of tools are especially good for auditory learners. So, because a lot of times people think auditory learners and that modality just needs to hear the information, but that's only half the story. They need to hear it. That's really important, but they also need to be able to talk it out. So
yes, because
if you've got,
as they hear themselves, they actually are learning.
Yes.
And processing. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, and like you were saying too, if the questions have weird phraseology and you rephrase it for them, they're learning, oh, this is how this kinds of question might be asked, and I'll recognize that a little bit better next time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you know, asking these kinds of questions can be very simple if you have a test that you just want to take and adapt and do it verbally instead of written. Mm-hmm. That's a real easy way to integrate questioning. You can just replace the paper text without doing too much prep.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do want to create your own set of questions, make sure that you have a solid basis of observation before moving on to interpretation,
mm-hmm.
and then interpretation before evaluation, and then just try and keep it as casual as you can, because we're doing this because testing probably gives our kids some level of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to keep it low key. I mean, it's okay for them to know they're being evaluated,
right.
But that doesn't have to come through in your tone. You know what I mean?
Yes, exactly. I'm your mother. I don't have to be all of a sudden enemy number one because I'm asking you questions from the workbook.
Yes. All right. So that's tool number one, is questioning. Tool number two is problem solving.
Which is a great thing. In our interview last week, we were talking to a diagnostician, and she said one of the things they look for is how well a student can solve problems and their method for going about that. And so it is something we have to teach our children how to do if they don't naturally just know how to solve problems. Some kids like problems.
Absolutely. Some of them do, and some of them just
those executive
blank.
Functioning issues really need to be walked through this step by step.
Yes. And the more practice they get and the more connections that they can start to make on their own, the better.
Exactly.
So I'll just give you an example of what I mean by a problem solving question. Oh, looks like my slides are out of order. I'm sorry about that. So here is the egg drop problem. Can you catch an egg from a 17-foot drop using nothing but 100 straws and a roll of masking tape so that the egg doesn't crack when it hits the ground? If you have egg, ladder, straws, and tape, and you've been talking about gravity, acceleration, if you've been doing some kind of like materials science, this is a great beginning physics kind of problem.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, just general science, this is a very fun activity, you know, to be handed 100 straws and a roll of masking tape and say, all right,
exactly.
You've got however much time we have this afternoon, build me a contraption that's going to keep the egg from breaking.
Yeah.
So two pictures here are from a student who had this exact problem. And they started off with a different design. It was triangular instead of square at the base. And they made some adjustments to make it a little bit more stable and used extra masking tape to create kind of a cushiony pad at the bottom, like a hammock to catch the egg. And so, you know, there's an element of math to it, but there's also an element of just kind of creativity and artistry. And they tested with three eggs, and two of the eggs did not crack. The third one missed the basket.
Oh, well, that had nothing to do with the design then.
No, except that it was a small target. So maybe in a future iteration of the design, we incorporate a wider funnel so that if your aim is off, you're less likely to splat. My mom used to do this kind of thing when I was a kid. We had something called Camp Friday, which was like a most of the day science camp for kids. It was just like a one-off co-op kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And instead of building a catcher, what we would do is she gave us straws, tape, and string and plastic bags, all, you know, horrible things for the environment. But our job was to build a contraption so that it would be attached to the egg and would land and keep the egg from cracking. So some people would put together, you know, because we've been talking about drag and air resistance, they would put together a parachute and tie it to their little egg lander. Other people, you know, we had talked about how suspensions work. So they would build a little cage with lots of like little sticks poking out to try and absorb the force of the impact. And you know, it hardly mattered if you succeeded or failed, as long as somebody succeeded, because it was just as much fun to see the egg crack. And you learned what worked and what didn't work, and that's just as valuable.
It
sometimes.
Is very valuable. Well, what did they say? Einstein failed a lot before he made the first light bulb, but he learned something every step of the way.
He learned a thousand things that wouldn't work.
Yes, exactly.
So here's some criteria for a good problem for your kids to solve. If you're going to give them a problem, you want to make sure these elements are included. So a statement of the problem.
Yep.
So the egg needs to get to the floor from this height.
Mm-hmm.
It will crack if you don't intervene.
Mm-hmm.
Next is the criteria for success. So you will be successful if the egg does not crack. When we pick it up, it has no fault lines. The parameters and limitations, you want to try and keep as few parameters as possible, because the more parameters you have, the more you're limiting their creativity.
I was just thinking of that, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in this case, your limitations and parameters are your materials. So you have 100 straws and one roll of masking tape.
Right, or also your height that you're dropping it from.
Yes, yep, it'll be 17 feet or out of a second story window or whatever you want it to be. Submission guidelines. This is in an experiment situation like this. Submission guidelines says, well, we're going to do the thing and see how it goes. But your problem might be something completely different. And their submission needs to be a Word document or an Excel sheet or a map that they have drawn or something like that. So, you know, if they need to email it into you or have it printed or typed or whatever it may be, you need to let them know how you expect to receive this information.
Yeah, definitely.
Then it's good to list the required skills and subject knowledge that they're going to need. So, hey, in order to do this, you're going to need to know how to use Excel, or you're going to need to know a little bit about beekeeping or whatever the problem requires.
Yes, exactly.
And that gives them some background information about what they need to know. And if they don't know one of these things, they have time at the beginning to go figure out, okay, I need to watch this tutorial and get this knowledge before I dig into it. Otherwise, I'm going to be halfway through my project and then get super frustrated because I didn't realize, oh no, I have to know how to attach a file.
Well, and you as a teacher should give that information to your student too.
Absolutely.
because a lot of times we'll just kind of give them a project and not think of all the little things that go into that. It's like when my daughter started using PowerPoint, you know, I walked her through the process and some tutorials on how to, you know, add different things to PowerPoint presentations. So she wasn't just, oh, just make a PowerPoint now of what you understood. Well, that leaves her at a deficit.
Yeah. I mean, PowerPoint isn't intuitive. If you've never used that kind of thing before, it is a, it's very intimidating.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
The number six is resources available. So this is a, here's some websites that you should consider browsing. Here's a calculator that might come in handy. Here are some people that you could interview. Here's a bunch of books that we checked out from the library. So give them a little nudge in the right direction about where to find this information. You're not solving the problem for them by doing that. You're just letting them know, here's what's available to you.
Right.
And then lastly, like we talked about before, the evaluation rubric. So you're going to be graded on, you know, handwriting and spelling counts, or maybe it doesn't, you know, if
exactly.
Mm-hmm. I'll never forget my, my freshman biomechanics class. I was a theater major, and biomechanics was about how to use your body as a performer and not injure yourself on stage when you're doing, you know, stage combat and gymnastics and stuff.
That's a good thing to know how to do.
Very useful, but it was all medical terminology and muscle groups and, you know, nerves and different parts of that had very hard to spell words.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget that I got every single problem on my final exam right, but I got a C because I misspelled 22 medical terms. But, you know, the professor said spelling counts, and I did not study the spelling. So I could have had a better grade on that, but I studied the wrong material. Well, so when your kids know what counts and what doesn't count, it frees them to do their best work.
It does. And then for my son, like, it gave him a checklist that he could go through when he was worried if he hadn't done it right, because he's this perfectionist and he had to make sure that everything was done exactly as it, you know, needed to be. And there was nothing that he was guessing at. And so it gave him a sense of security that he was doing the right things and spending time on what he should be spending time on that mattered. So, yeah, definitely love the rubrics. And there's ways to create your own rubrics online.
Oh, absolutely.
A lot of different tools out there.
And that there's a whole series of workshops just on rubrics that you could host, I'm sure.
Teachers that love them a lot.
Mm-hmm. So as you're thinking about what kinds of projects and or problems you want your students to do, just be aware of your subject matter and be thinking as you're doing your early stage lesson planning, you know, because we like to read through ahead, how can we create a good problem here? And these are really useful in science. These are really useful in math and some of those harder, more objective kinds of subjects. It's a little harder to do in literature, a little harder to do in history, but not impossible. You can certainly do them in the arts. So your music and composition, or theater, those kinds of things, you can easily set up problems. It takes a little bit of creativity and it takes some work to make these, but they are a super effective tool to evaluate, because if they can do this, then clearly they've demonstrated some high level of mastery over their subject material.
Exactly.
But you want to make sure that you've prepared them for it and that they have all the skills and the subject knowledge, and you want them to do this as independently as possible. They can come to you when they have questions and when they don't know where to go next, but you really want to avoid doing the work for them here, because that kind of defeats the purpose of this kind of evaluation. All right, so that's tool number two. We've talked about questionings, we talked about problems. Tool number three is projects.
Yeah.
So when we say projects, there's oftentimes in good homeschool curriculum, there's lots of different hands-on projects, but there's a difference between using a project for learning and using a project for assessment.
Yes, that's a very good point.
So a lot of our projects that are going to be in the book are there to cement your learning. They're there to give you a hands-on experience so that you can make strong neural connections between the experience you just had and the material. And that's great. That's incredibly useful and so, so important. But not all projects make good assessment tools.
Yeah, because you're usually helping and you're part of that process. And yeah, it is like you said, a lot of times where, especially like we did unit studies, it was project-based learning almost all the time, but I wasn't assessing my kids through what they were doing often because I was part of the project usually.
Right. And a lot of those are, you know, if you go back to that Bloom's pyramid, they're stopping at the application level, maybe the analysis, maybe, or they're having you do creation kinds of things, but really it's, you know, it feels creative because you're allowed to be artistic with it, but it's really just application level, just because, you know, making a folder book isn't necessarily a creation kind of a thing. You're not making something new and solving a problem and creating a new kind of idea or proposing a new kind of solution. You're just building a good repository for the things that you've learned. So useful, but not for assessment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I wanted to give an example of a product that has kind of all of those different Bloom levels built into it. So you can have lots of different kinds of products. This is, I want you, my student, to write a letter to King John. So the product is a letter. So here's the scenario. King John, Prince John, if you prefer, the infamous one, has written to you as an impartial third party looking for advice on whether or not to sign the Magna Carta. Write a letter back to King John, offering him your advice. Your letter should include a summary of the events leading up to his current situation, an explanation of the content of the Magna Carta, and predictions about how signing it might impact his reign. Be sure to explain the consequences of either decision.
That's laid out.
So this has a lot of pieces that are kind of baked into it. If you put it through our questioning model, you've got remembering and understanding, summarize the events leading up to John's current situation, and explain the content of the Magna Carta. All right, so that's your basic background knowledge. Your application and analysis, that's your interpretation questions. So predict how signing or not signing the Magna Carta might impact King John's reign. And then lastly, your evaluation and creation level question is, give King John advice on whether or not to sign the Magna Carta. Advice is a evaluation and creation level thought process. And now you might have one of those students who says, all right, Mom, I've written this letter, but I need to tell you, I'm giving him bad advice on purpose because I think he's a terrible king. And I know that if he doesn't sign this, he's going to have a revolt and he's going to get deposed and I want him off the throne. So this is bad advice, but I did the letter just like you asked me to. if you have one of those kids, he has just added a whole nother meta level to this activity and has already demonstrated before you even pick up the letter, he's got a certain level of mastery of this material.
Exactly.
If he can predict that that's what would happen with bad advice.
Right, exactly.
He's thinking on a whole nother tactical level. Mm-hmm. Now, but if you have a student who's having a hard time just explaining what's in the Magna Carta, that tells you, all right, this is what we need to review. This is what actually happened. And this is what might have happened if things had turned out differently. So you know one way or the other where they are and what you need to do next.
If you as a parent, I mean, it's nice that you lay these out because it's hard to sometimes decipher what am I actually asking and how can I build all that in? But I like how you broke it all out to kind of show how each of these phases are built into that, you know, one one assignment.
Well, and it's important in that one assignment, you have a lot of different questions in there, but there's only one very high level piece to it. There's only one evaluation and creation level question.
Letters or yes, it's all included in that one piece. Yep.
So here's just a bunch of ideas for different projects and products that you could use. And I've broken them into some different categories. So there's oral projects, literary projects, visual, kinesthetic, and digital. And if you're big into learning styles, you'll probably recognize, you know, auditory, visual, and kinesthetic learners. Some models also have read-write as a learning style. And then digital is a category that a lot of the learning style models just don't really have a place for yet.
So. Right. Yeah. So that was the one my kids always opted for. My son started a podcast and my daughter likes the PowerPoints the films. Kind of we're new on that.
But you can get so much information from any of these kinds of activities, even if it's not their favorite type of project. They all have so much value. Like, you know, for the oral projects, like speeches or dramatizations. I mean, I told you about that one with Socrates. That was such useful data. No paper test could have told us all the things that she knew, and they could have told us the things that she didn't know, but they couldn't have told us what she did.
Yeah.
A literary activity like the letter writing thing that we just talked about, that's a good product. Visual learner.
She was reading about, I can't remember the name of the, Sherlock Holmes, reading some of his short stories, but in the short stories, they don't describe him really that much. And I said, draw what you think he'd look like, based off of the little bits of information you get out of these short stories. And so she had to kind of compile all of these, ways that he was talked to and, just what kind of man would he have looked like? Was he presentable or,
Oh, that's fantastic.
And so she really struggled with that, just trying to figure out what he would look like based on these short stories all put together and just, the demeanor of people who approached him because of what you look like, people approach you differently and how they talk to you. And so that was a really good way to use her artistic gift to analyze literature.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So that's a great visual activity. And it's funny, a lot of people, would see literary activities and think, oh, okay, that's related to literature studies. But no, you can use any of these for any subject.
Right, you really can, yeah.
My wife she's a very visual person and she hated geometry class except for this one project that she did. She was in a theater production and was working on the set and she had to build a column. And in particular, she was in charge of taking a big block of foam and turning it into the capital top piece of the column.
Right.
And she wanted it to be, a perfect trapezoidal kind of thing, like a pyramid with the top cut off. So she used all the theorems that she had been learning in geometry and wrote out a whole page of the equations that she would need to get all the angles right. And then she built it and she brought it all into her geometry teacher. Now, this is such a missed opportunity because the teacher made it very clear that she didn't like geometry and she was just teaching it so that they could do well on the SATs. And she saw this hard work that Helen had done and was like, that wasn't assigned. But now she can use this.
Well, and unfortunately, geometry is taught theoretically. It's not taught in application. And so a lot of kids that are very good visual learners don't get geometry because it isn't taught that way. I know we did paper folding for geometry with my middle child, and he excelled at it because he's a visual learner. And this is only
math. That's great.
But... yeah.
Kinesthetic projects can be a little bit harder because they're often a little bit more in depth and sometimes require more of us as parents. But that's okay.
Rubric for those types of things.
Yes. Yeah, it certainly can. And they require a lot of creativity on the part of the kids too. So they're so, you know, not every kid is going to want to get up and do, you know, a pantomime about something, but some kids just gravitate towards that naturally. I remember a few years back, we had gotten our hands on some dry ice, and we were doing some science experiments with dry ice and talking about the three states of matter. And our kids learned all about, you know, solid, liquid, and gas, and the molecules being close together and far apart, and energy levels and such. And, you know, the youngest is probably four of the three of them who were walking through this lesson. And the oldest was probably eight or something like that. And at the end of it, the three of them, without even prompting, because this is just how they are, they did an interpretive dance for us on the states of matter. So when they were solids, the three of them were bundled up real closely together, and they were moving really slowly. And when they got to liquid, they started moving around a little bit more and had a fluid motion and started spreading out a little bit. And then when they got to gas, they were just zipping all around the room, filling the space as much as they could. And, you know, the four-year-old was never going to be able to fill out a paper test or even answer many questions about states of matter. But that interpretive dance told me they got it. Like,
exactly.
All of those main points were in there. And they could turn it into just this hysterical little two-step all over the living room. It was great.
And that's the beauty of alternative assessments. You know, everything we've been talking about is that that seems maybe so complicated, because we can talk about all the background, like stuff that's involved with evaluating and, you know, creating these types of assessments, but it can make it very accessible for kids who understand things, like your four-year-old can understand concepts that maybe we wouldn't even teach, but oftentimes they're in the same room when we homeschool.
Yep.
Those things.
Yep. I was the little brother. Half of my education was through osmosis.
I know. My 15-year-old at this point could have graduated last year because of all that she learned. And I was like, I'm not ready for you to go yet. So we're doing college algebra and physics and slowing down. Yeah. She just learned way too much too early.
What a wonderful problem.
Yes, it really is. No way to spend a lot of mom daughter time. So, are we wrapping up?
We are. Yeah, I know we're about out of time. If there's any Q&A, we've got time for that. But really, I just want to encourage everybody, if you've got a kid who doesn't test well, there's so many other ways of assessing them. And if you've got a rubric, then you've got your documentation.
Exactly. Yeah, and it's an easy way to score it and keep track of all of that information in one place.
Yeah, and maybe we'll have to come back and do a workshop on rubric building. But
yeah.
it's so much more, like you said, it's so much more accessible. And it can be a fun, happy memory instead of the anxiety of sitting down for a test. Mm-hmm. And really, I mean, we want homeschooling to foster a love of learning, not a dread of learning. So even if your kid does test well, these are great ways to get them out of their little paper box. Because sometimes those kids need to be challenged to do things outside of the area where they're most skilled. And
I have a friend, with
a little bit of planning and a little bit of creativity and preparation, you can take these kinds of things and just go so far with them.
Yeah. And it seems like now the colleges are wanting to see more projects,
like
in high school. If your children are working on these or they have these things, keep them in a portfolio. Because a friend of mine whose son went to Harvard, she said, all my son knows how to do is take tests. Well, he wasn't homeschooled. But so she's like, what do we put in the portfolio? He only takes tests. Well, and so so it's becoming a more of an advantage, you know, if your children are college bound, to keep track of these things.
Absolutely. And you get so many other related skills when you're putting together a PowerPoint or a wiki or a podcast, or even just doing an infographic or a dramatization in front of other people. Like, public speaking is a skill unto itself, and it's hard.
Yes.
For some students, it's really hard, but it's so worth branching out from the paper assessments.
Yeah.
But the thing that I would just encourage people to remember is start with those levels, you know, start with observation and go far with that before you move on to interpretation, and then keep your evaluation to, I don't want to say to a minimum, but don't overburden them with evaluation questions, because that takes a lot of thought and creativity, and you can learn a lot from one question. You don't need 10.
Exactly. Yes. You don't need 100 questions, you know, to give them a midterm exam or something.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So with just a little bit of forethought and planning and creativity, you can really go a long way with these.
Definitely. So. And at the very beginning, I shared a link. So if you were thinking, oh, I joined you guys late, I wanted to see all these slides, great. Just click on the link and you'll be able to download and see all of Tyler's PowerPoint there. So
yeah, and there's some extra slides that we didn't cover today that have a little bit of bibliography. There's some question stems that you can use, or example questions for all the different levels of Bloom's taxonomy, just to stimulate your creativity a little bit. Make sure you download that PowerPoint. It's a PDF, so even if you don't have PowerPoint, you can still use it.
That's great. Yeah, PDFs are easy. And if you missed mine and Tyler's first interview, we talked about Demystifying Learning Styles, and that's his book right there, which is a very good read. Very short, but very, you know, concise, good information. So definitely check that out and all your other resources at Bright Ideas Press. So, thanks.
Thank you so much. I appreciate being asked here. This has been fun.
Yeah, this has been great. And I want to thank, I think we had one more comment. Kristen Marie said she was following. Thanks for watching, Kristen, and Crystal, who commented earlier. We definitely appreciate you guys just letting us know you're there. We can see your the eyeball gives us how many people are watching, but oftentimes we don't know who you are. So thanks for introducing yourselves. But definitely visit brightideaspress.com. And just want to thank you, Tyler. This has been so much good information. And for parents, especially when we stress about how do I know what my child knows and how do I figure that out, you've kind of taken it and given us some pretty applicable steps that we can follow, which is nice, because oftentimes it just seems very confusing as to what they do know. And
it can be overwhelming, but it doesn't need to be.
Yep. Well, you showed that for sure.
Well, thank you, Peggy. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing with us. And we're going to continue the month of March and tips and hints for teaching. We're going to switch on to writing next week. We're going to be talking with Sarah Collins of Collins Academy Therapy Services, and she's going to be talking about the impact and development of pre-writing skills for greater learning. And so just all those pre-writing skills. So if you've got younger children or know anybody that homeschools younger children, definitely join in. Or if you just have a struggling writer, those are things that we're going to be talking about. She's an occupational therapist, and so she's going to be talking about some different ways to work on those skills. I have a 20-year-old that's still working on writing skills. That's a very difficult thing for him to do. So we all have things we can learn from that. But we just want to thank Tyler for his time, and definitely check out his resources and check out spedhomeschool.com. We have a lot of resources on our website that can help you to homeschool your struggling learner, and also join one of your, we have new Sped Strong tribes. And so your tribe is a regional group that you can join and keep this conversation going all week long with that group. So until next week, have an awesome week, everybody. And we'll see you right here, same time, same place. Night, everyone.
Good night.